Welcome to the 58th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
I'm Toby Charles.
And as much of the UK panics about UKIP's stunning triumph in the European parliamentary election, welcome to the podcast that's at least glad that Nigel Farage chose to celebrate his big win with a day out at the cricket.
Of course, this is the story that Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP and the new hero of British politics, well, hero is one way of putting it, celebrated his victory in the recent European elections by going and seeing Kent play down at Tunbridge, and apparently had a very nice day out too.
It's all sort of part of his pint-swilling guy next door image, isn't it? You know, he didn't want to be celebrating at Party HQ. He thought, no, what would a typical Englishman do? I'll go to the cricket.
I think we're very rapidly going to become very depressed if we talk any more about the results of the European election in Britain. There is one thing, however, that has been keeping us a bit happier, and that's the fact that the county season is now in full swing, and both of us have had our eyes on different parts of the schedule. Something that's caught my eye is a remarkable innings that happened in Somerset last week against Warwickshire, where in and of itself it was a remarkable thing. For the 10th wicket, Somerset put on 69 runs from 9.3 overs, which is one of those kind of glorious incidents of lower order batsmanship. But what made it even more remarkable was the fact that the batsmen who were involved in this were a pair of identical twins, Jamie and Craig Overton. And they're both only 20 years old, so we've got this nice sort of fact that they're identical twins, the fact that they're very young as well. So hopefully, we're hoping that these are going to be the next kind of war twins of the international scene, and that they're going to be a big thing for both Somerset and for England.
It's very exciting to see two young Englishmen bowling at pace and making inroads in first-class cricket at that young age. And the other interesting thing, without sounding too UKIP about this, is that a lot of the prospects at the moment for the England team have actually come through other development systems. You know, Sam Robson from Australia, Gary Balance from Zimbabwe. I mean, Chris Jordan, who really is from very much Barbadian heritage. And while I think it's, you know, we're long past this whole Kevin Peterson, does it matter where you come from debate, I think it's still maybe encouraging to see that the English development system is still coming up with some hot prospects.
Absolutely. And I think from Somerset's perspective as well, we've known from kind of long experience that the clubs that are often the most resilient are the clubs that are able to take on players quite young and then see them through, rather than get a whole load of kind of 29-year-old international superstars to come in. So it's quite nice from Somerset's perspective, actually, that they've got these 20-year-olds who are really developing early for them. But there are players as well who are developing at the other end of their careers for Somerset at the moment.
Indeed. I mean, Marcus Trezeguet, I think he must be one of the most popular English cricketers of his generation. I think it's a combination of a carefree way he's always played, very likeable personality. And I guess the other thing, that his honesty about his battle with depression, I think, has earned him a lot of admiration as well. He endured a terrible 2013, averaged just 28 in the county championship. And I think given that he's now 38, there was a general feeling that this was probably the end. You know, it was the sort of final decline. Instead, he's had a real renaissance this season. He's averaging a shade under 60. He's hit two match-winning hundreds for Somerset, both very different. A real battling one in terrible conditions at Hove, where he was really the only person on either side to get to grips with the conditions. And then a brilliant run-a-ball effort the other week to get Somerset home in a game where they were really under time pressure against Durham. And we've talked quite a bit, well, maybe today we've talked about the Overtons. I remember last episode we talked quite a lot about the pleasure in discovering an emerging talent. But there's also a huge satisfaction in seeing the brilliance of a player who you thought would never be able to produce his best again. And I think let's hope that Trezeguet can enjoy a real Indian summer this year.
And certainly there's quite a lot of satisfaction as well in seeing a player kind of adjust their game towards the end of their career. You know, maybe they don't have this, their reflexes aren't as fast, they're not as quick, they're not as strong maybe, their eyes not as good. But actually, the real skill for the kind of maturing pro, which makes me sound like I'm sort of calling him an OAP of some description. But, you know, you saw it mostly perhaps with Sachin Tendulkar, the way that he adjusted his game towards the end of his career until it went a bit wrong and he couldn't get his 100th.
You're quite right. There's something admirable in finding a way somehow to get it done. Now, you as our Australian correspondent have bad news to report from the land of Oz.
Well, it's not really bad news. It's more just sort of depressing news. So the Big Bash League, and yes, the Big Bash League in and of itself is depressing news, but we'll try and be optimistic for the time being. Anyway, it's been around for 3 years now, and when it was set up, there was kind of this hope that it wasn't going to be an IPO. It wasn't going to be kind of completely dictated by money and corruption and everything else. But the reality is that inevitably where there's money involved, there's kind of dirty dealing and corruption involved. And over the first 3 years, there was this rule, there always has been this rule, that basically there's this transfer window within which deals can be made, approaches can be made, and transactions can be made. And in the past, people have clearly flaunted this to the extent that, you know, you get 10 minutes into a transfer window and people will be signing deals. So clearly they've been talking about it before they got into the transfer window, which is not allowed. Anyway, here we are 3 years in, and there has been a call for an amnesty on all of the dodgy dealings that's happened in the past. The idea is that everything's going to be brought out into the open, laid on the table, and suddenly, somehow, there's going to be some kind of clean slate, which enables all of the teams to then go back and abide by the rules, and apparently everyone's going to live happily ever after, and there's going to be no corruption, etc., etc. And it's just a depressingly familiar situation, and it just seems ridiculously naive to think that now the genie's out of the bottle, now that everyone realises that they can make more money by making underhand deals with players and everything like that, it seems ridiculous to assume that that can ever, you know, that can ever be reversed.
Has this caused much of a fuss in Australia?
It's difficult to know what causes a fuss in Australia because the media in Australia is so fragmented. So it's quite difficult for things to sort of turn into a national scandal, really, in a sense. But certainly it has been reported on. I forget his name, but one of the administrators has been sacked. And clearly there is, you know, I'm not saying that there's not goodwill to do something about it. It's, you know, clearly the fact that the situation has arisen indicates the fact that people realise that there is a situation to be taken advantage of. And it just seems a bit naive to think that that's ever going to be gone back on. And it's just a bit disappointing that the optimism that originally surrounded the Big Bash League is so clearly wrong.
And I guess my focus this week has been on another area of scandal where I think a lot of us thought we'd maybe got past it. And it's this whole issue of suspect actions. We had Stuart Broad causing controversy with a tweet about Syed Ajmal's action. Over in the IPL, we had West Indian Kevin Cooper who's been reported for his action. There are these ongoing grumbles going on about young Sri Lankan Sashithra Sananayake. Basically, the whole issue of suspect actions, I just feel, remains far too prominent in cricket. I do have some sympathy for the ICC on this because they've tried really hard, actually, to come up with an effective and fair process. But it still hasn't got rid of this climate of uncertainty. It's really unfair, I think, on the players involved, especially the young ones who find themselves constantly under pressure, under questioning. Do they have to reform their actions? Don't they? But I think it actually, and I know it's not to the same extent as something like match fixing, but it does really undermine the integrity of the game. I mean, if I lose to a team whose main bowler who does the damage, a few months later he's then found out to have a suspect action, I mean, does that invalidate first result?
And I suppose the problem is that however far the ICC can come up with their kind of biomechanical tests about the 18th degree hyperextension of the elbow or whatever the, you know, whatever the stuff is that they come up with, however much that happens, there's still going to be so much rumour that surrounds it. It is quite a widely accepted thing, actually, that, you know, with the naked eye, something looks wrong, which actually is right, and vice versa, and all that kind of thing. And it's kind of inherent in this whole thing of chucking that it's just going to be surrounded by rumour forever.
From the archives, and this episode, Toby will be telling us the tale of a team that in the 1890s had Arthur Conan Doyle playing for them, and in the modern day has Sebastian Faulks. This is the story of the Authors 11.
The Authors 11's original incarnation was as the Al Hacker Barrys that we first came across on this podcast in a brilliant book by Kevin Telfer. They were created by Rudyard Kipling. They were a team which had all the kind of literary elite of the time playing for them. There's H.G. Wells, Arthur Conan Doyle, P.G. Woodhouse, G.K. Chesterton, Jerome K. Jerome, and A. Milne. So this was really kind of the core of cultural life in England, going out playing cricket at the weekends. And one of the things that we wondered when we read this book was, wouldn't it actually be amazing to have been a fly on the wall sometimes? All of these amazing literary characters, all of their amazing imaginations, and there they were playing, you know, the most stimulating of games, or we like to think it's the most stimulating of games. Wouldn't it have been great to see the japes they got up to, the fun things they did, the, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, it's something that kind of I come across quite a lot when I'm reading about cricket of the past. I was reading the other day about the Hollywood Cricket Club of the 1930s, and would just have loved to see this group of Americans, you know, to have actually been there seeing this group of Americans playing cricket. But anyway, so we fast forward a century to 2012, and the Al Haqqar Barrys, who ended in about 1910, have been reformed, and they've been reformed as something called, as Andy said, the Authors 11. And among them is Sebastian Foulkes, who wrote Birdsong, and then various other. I mean, it's not quite the same list of luminaries that we have in the original Al Haqqar Barrys, but it's an impressive list of authors nevertheless. And one thing that they definitely share in common with the Al Haqqar Barrys is their complete incompetence at cricket, whilst also being the kind of creme de la creme of the literary world. So of this Authors 11 founded in 2012, one had experience of top-level cricket. Several others were occasional cricketers, but there was one female member who'd never played ever again. And then there was Charlie Campbell, who was the team captain and a literary agent, who confesses that he was only once selected, aged 10, for a school team. But he's recently, quotes, rediscovered the joys of playing cricket badly.
What do you think would... I mean, it's interesting, this idea that you have people who are brilliant in their field, and they then decide to play a sport that, you know, none of them have a natural ability for. I mean, in some ways, it's a wonderful advertisement for all of us who can take a lot of satisfaction from playing cricket, whatever standard we're at. Doesn't it? It really underlines that fact that cricket can be enjoyed by those of all abilities.
It really does. And the other thing, I mean, there are sort of two points that I want to make about the Authors 11, and two things that I kind of find quite attractive about the whole thing. The first of which is the fact that the Authors 11 are made up of, you know, people who play cricket like you and I do. They go off on Saturdays, they get told off by their wives and girlfriends for doing so. You know, they have to eat, they eat too much at tea, they leave their pads behind and have to borrow some keeping pads to bat in and everything like this. So it's the same experience, but it's then told and it's narrated by people who have a real skill in narrating. And then the second thing that I think is interesting about them is that thing I was talking about with the Al Haqqar Barrys, where you sort of want to really be a fly on the wall and find out about what they're thinking and the stuff that's going on and everything like that. You really can with the Authors 11 through the joys of social media. And I know it sounds ridiculous to say that we should look at these, you know, significant writers through the prism of Twitter and Facebook, but actually the kind of instant accessibility that you get and the kind of day-to-day accessibility that you get is a really wonderful thing. I mean, I suppose my thinking was triggered by, I was on their Twitter page, and I saw this wonderful tweet which just said it's tweeting to various members of the team, and including Tom Holland, who's an ancient historian who writes quite a lot of interesting pieces for the FT and various other places. And then it says, please play for us on Saturday, !! Email me at authorscc@gmail.com. And it's just this wonderful thing that you can imagine that if, you know, you'd had J.M. Barrie writing to Arthur Conan Doyle saying, you've got to come and play this Saturday, we're short of players. You know, that kind of thing would be selling at auction for millions of pounds, and we kind of revere it. And yet we've kind of got this insight into a similar kind of world that's completely readily available on social media.
I wonder if, in a similar way to the original Al Haqqar Barrys, a lot of this is about a release of pressure, a kind of relaxed place where, because they're bad at cricket, because, you know, being an author is so much about that constant attention, what do the critics think of you, will history remember you, it must be an incredibly relaxed place for them to be, a cricket field where nothing's expected of them. The one thing that I wonder, it may be perhaps the most dramatic change between the Authors 11 of the present and of the past, is the Al Haqqar Barrys, what insight we did get of them, what we do know of them, they were very much these gentlemen of leisure. You know, they were enjoying these wonderful sort of freewheeling lives. And I guess the slightly sad thing that probably sums up most of our lives today is that probably isn't quite the case with the Authors 11 today. Cricket's probably squeezed in between, you know, many, many other commitments and things.
And well, you do, and that's...
That time.
Again, that's something that I think we as the kind of casual players can share in common with that kind of ideology of the club. There was quite an amusing thing on their Facebook page the other day, which was kind of the typical thing of, you know, early season excitement tempered with the fact that you're suddenly realising, hang on, I'm going to have no time this summer. And there's this wonderful thing that said, just over 3 weeks until our cricket season starts. In our first season, we had 14 games. In our second, 24. This summer, despite my best efforts to keep the numbers down, we'll have over a month's worth of cricket playing actors, journalists, paleontologists, priests, publishers, and the odd professional cricketer. And so there is this kind of, sense of it being, it's not the idyllic escape that it was when J.M. Barry and people were playing. And actually, that I think is quite a nice connection that we can have with this. To the review. In this episode, we've been reading Field of Shadows by Dan Waddell. Now, we've all been on some pretty remarkable cricket tours, but I'd suggest that this is probably the most remarkable cricket tour of all time. It's the story of the Worcestershire Gents visiting Nazi Berlin in 1937.
Perhaps one of the most remarkable things about this tale is how we haven't heard about it before, and I think we find out the reason for that quite early on in Waddell's book, which is that it's very poorly documented, and it's extremely interesting at the start of the book to let Waddell guide us through the hunt that he had to go through to find anything about it. We go through all the dead ends that he pursues when he finally starts to get small scraps of information that build into meaningful leads. He gets in touch with family members, many of whom at start don't know what he's talking about, but eventually are able to go into their attics and find something. And there's this wonderful moment where he finds Peter Robinson's scrapbook, Peter Robinson being one of the youngest players on the tour, and he'd kept this wonderfully precise scrapbook, all the tickets and everything, with notes and diaries from the tour. And you certainly share Waddell's thrill in suddenly having found a way into this story.
Now, for me, there were kind of two revelations, I suppose, within the book. One of which is this story that you're talking about, which is the story of 1937 and the tour and the Worcestershire players going over there. The other thing was this story about German cricket generally. I mean, I had a kind of vague awareness that at some point someone must have played cricket in Germany. But I wasn't aware, for instance, as Waddell claims, and I have no reason to disbelieve him, that the first ever book written on cricket was written in Germany and in German. Similarly, that there was an active cricket scene. It wasn't huge, it was a minority, but there was an active cricket scene in Berlin in the first half of the 20th century. And a lot of this was very much down to the fact that there were these kind of dedicated individuals, German individuals, who had fallen in love with the game. And one of the heroes, if not the hero of the book, actually, is a chap called Felix Menzel, who is kind of single-handedly attempting to keep cricket going in Berlin. And the book opens with this wonderful image of after the Cold War has set in, after the Second World War, and there are some British soldiers standing on the western side of the Berlin Wall, and these people come to them and they think, what are they going to do? Are they going to ask for food? Are they going to try and kill us? Whatever. And one of them just says, can you play a game of cricket with us? And this person is Felix Menzel, and he really is the character who stands, I think, at the centre of the book.
And the book achieves many, many things, but hopefully one of them will be to establish Menzel as sort of one of the great cricket pioneers. Inevitably, this is a book about politics, and I think it's fascinating to see what a group of Englishmen who had no particular political bent or stance made of what they saw of Nazi Germany in the mid-30s. And I think one thing that's quite interesting is the extent to which the Nazi regime were at pains to kind of hide the reality from the touring party. They made sure to kind of insulate the team from a lot of what was going on. But they still couldn't get away from this sort of sense of unease. There's this very well-documented scene of the Worcestershire gentlemen's discomfort when they're expected to give a Nazi salute. And I think it really strongly evokes this idea of a very ordinary group of Englishmen coming into contact with fascism for the first time and just really struggling what to make of it. They kind of want to be courteous, but they're also aware that they're dealing with something very outside their realms of understanding.
That's one of the central, not conflicts necessarily, but one of the central paradoxes at the heart of the book is that on the one hand, you know that the Second World War and the Holocaust is just around the corner. But at the same time, you just have these wonderful and quite amusing stories of the cricket matches that kind of carry on in a sense, despite all of what you've said, sort of carry
on regardless. And some of the most amusing bits in the book are when you hear about the kind of idiosyncrasies of the German game. So there are things like the fact that they appeal for absolutely everything. If the ball hits you on the pad, they will appeal, regardless of you know, you're standing at square leg, you're expected to appeal as a German. The second thing is the quite amusing fact that they insist on having a photographer to document all the games. And the photographer stands at something like silly mid-off or something like that, and just won't move. And the batsman goes in and expects that, you know, he'll just take a picture of him while he's taking his guard or something like that. But the Germans just don't bat an eyelid at the fact that this photographer is standing there at silly mid-off. And there are some quite amusing pictures that come off out of it as a result. And then I think the most sort of astonishing thing is the fact that the captain goes around and will just punch fielders if they drop catches. And there's a wonderful moment where at the end of the tour, the English captain is asked, the Worcestershire captain is asked what he would do to improve the German game. And he said, well, you know, it's not very good for morale if you're punching your players if they drop catches. You know, it's not the kind of culture that you want within the team. And the German kind of looks quizzical, shrugs his shoulder and says, but they were very easy catches.
It does suggest a very different understanding of cricket etiquette. But I think you're quite right that the book does have this constant tension between, I guess, the relative frivolity of the cricket and the seriousness of the political scene. And the Worcestershire gentlemen, for much of the book, come across as these sort of cricket-loving dilettantes. They're generally men of leisure. They have plenty of money. They're in Berlin, living it up, enjoying the cricket. You know, this is one of many tours. They go sort of all around the place having these fun tours. But then the book moves on to the extraordinary exploits of the individual Worcestershire gentleman during the war. And you have these extraordinary tales of heroics. And I think it makes you realise that you were dealing in an era where a lot of these people, almost as a matter of course, had to find themselves in extraordinary positions. They almost didn't have any choice, and they went from being in the mid-30s kind of comfortable gentlemen of leisure to being at the front line in the 40s. And it's sobering, but also extremely moving.
So that's Dan Waddell's Field of Shadows. It's just been published, and we couldn't recommend it highly enough.
And finally, to the debate. And this episode, we're asking whether any cricket fan who gets angry with his team is taking it all a little too seriously. Now, this idea for a debate came to me when I was looking over the internet outrage that greeted England being bowled out for 99 against Sri Lanka. And you had all these comments about how so-and-so's a disgrace, it's disgusting, etc., etc. And I suddenly realised, isn't this all a little bit too much? Haven't we all got carried away? This is a sport that ultimately we should follow for enjoyment and for pleasure. And to the extent that we're getting outraged about it, isn't it now doing us almost more harm than good?
I think there's something certainly to be said for the fact that you kind of lose sight of enjoying the game of cricket as a whole if you get so bound up in the fortunes of a particular team, and that, you know, you can't just appreciate good cricket all round if it's not there. But I think there's another thing, which is that it's important to think about what people are getting angry about. So I think it's quite justified for people to get angry about match fixing or corruption or kind of general gross incompetence from people who really should know better. But then it's not really justifiable, like the German captain we were just talking about, for someone to get angry enough to punch their players in the face if they've dropped a catch when they're clearly amateurs who've never been taught how to catch properly.
Yeah,
so I think there are probably degrees on the scale of how angry you can get and what you can get angry about.
I think on the first point, I think this idea of following a team definitely does lead you to see that team's games in a very different way. You can't enjoy them dispassionately. And I mean, I think we both found ourselves in positions of sorrow repeatedly over the winter as England struggled in the Ashes. But I guess I can see the value actually in following a team and enjoying that. You know, I can't think of a less annoying phrase than, I suppose, emotional journey. You know, you enjoy the ups and the downs, and that's all fun. But I guess when those ups and downs turn to sort of anger, that does sort of seem too much. I guess the question is whether being bowled out for 99 by Sri Lanka merits anger. I mean, I think you're dealing, you know, the argument you can make is you say, oh God, these guys are professional cricketers. You know, that's a disgrace for their performance. But then at the same time, you think, well, they're presumably committed. I guess that's maybe where the question lies.
Yep.
I think once you start doubting the commitment, that perhaps is the point at which we consider anger might become justifiable.
Can I sort of turn this on its head a bit, and without getting too semantic, just kind of anger, because what we would describe as anger in sport now, what you've defined anger as being something, you know, you go onto an internet chat room and you write some nasty things about, you know, the England batsman's competence and stuff like that. That kind of anger is very different from how we might have defined anger if we'd been on the football terraces of Northern England 25 years ago, where when teams lost, there were frequently, you know, violence and severe injury. So I think actually, you know, in a sense, we have to be careful about, you know, what anger is. And, you know, often I think perhaps those people who go onto the internet and complain about the England team, they're kind of disgruntled rather than necessarily angry. Angry is quite a strong thing, no, perhaps, in that context.
I think that is a useful distinction. But I think, I guess, the example that then comes to mind where this does genuinely go too far, and I think we could all agree it goes too far, is we think of Yuvraj Singh and his house being pelted with stones by Indian fans, yep, after his performance. And I guess, I suppose that's the example where, you know, that seemed like genuine anger, and that I think
the reality is that we'd rather have people online writing nasty things about Peter Moores than throwing rocks at batsmen's houses.
Yes, and I think your distinction between disgruntlement and anger is a good one. But then I suppose it also comes down to what it means to support a team. Because I think if you describe yourself as an England supporter, shouldn't you be getting behind them in the hard times? Shouldn't you be aware of the fact that teams have good days and bad days? And shouldn't
shouldn't the day
when they get bowled out for 99, shouldn't that be the day when, you know, you're clapping the tail enders in encouragingly as they come out to salvage the situation? I mean,
but again, just briefly, I think that goes back to my original point about what the cause behind it is. Because yes, you can get behind them if they're having a hard time and la-di-da, but if it's because they've been out the night before drinking the night away and, you know, visiting the young ladies of the town, then perhaps one would have less sympathy with them, and, you know, it's less a case of getting behind them and more a case of, you know, showing them a little bit of disgruntlement, anger, whatever we want to call it.
And I guess it's up to us to guess whether we think the commitment's there. I mean, certainly towards the end of the Ashes, I think a lot of England fans genuinely began to doubt that, and there became this point that was repeatedly made about, do they understand the badge they're playing for? You know, do they understand the importance of representing England? And I think we as fans began to make that judgment, even though I guess we never really know.